Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, I'm going to start today's show with a question, as I often like to do. And that question, or the questions I have for you, are, do you think you own your own body? Do you think you can control and dispose of your body parts as you wish? And do you believe you must give consent to receive experimental treatments? Well, my first guest today says, if you do, think again. You'll want to hear what Harriet Washington has to say. It's important information that affects your health and our medical future. And I'll introduce her in just a moment. Also joining us today, Dr. Natalie Strand. And she says, if you think having diabetes is an excuse for not living out loud, well, she too wants you to think again. She is an interventional pain physician, and Dr. Strand has had diabetes type 1 herself since she was 12 years old. She not only ran the amazing race with diabetes, she and her fellow traveler, also doctor, became the first ever all-female team to win the amazing race. So I'm looking forward to talking to both of my guests today. Lots of really great information to share. So let me bring on my first guest. She has been a fellow in medical ethics at the Harvard Medical School, a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, and the recipient of a John S. Knight Fellowship at Stanford University. I'd like to welcome Harriet Washington to the show today. Pleased to have you here, Harriet.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. What a great book you've written. I should also say that you are the author of the award-winning book, Medical Apartheid, and the book we're discussing today, and I'm going to read the full title of that. It's called Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and Our Medical Future. Ominous title there. The book has been compared in some ways to the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, because it tells in detail just how much the profit motive has colonized human life and compromised medical ethics. We know that the profit drives the majority of corporate decisions today. But when I see some of the issues here, Harriet, even I was shocked. Tell us why you felt this book compelled to write this book, because it is an intense book. A lot of research went into this.
Yes, I thought the book was very important because although most Americans are well aware that we've now experiencing a crisis in healthcare, unaffordable medications, a dearth of medications for those illnesses that affect us most, and the third world, of course, is dying for lack of medications that should be available to them. It should be reasonable, but are priced beyond their means. In addition, we also have a cultural crisis where we have medical researchers who are no longer motivated by altruism, but are rather have adopted corporate mentality. But I think even though most Americans are aware of this, very few people understand that they all emanate from a single set of laws passed in the year 1980. These laws were passed that catalyzed a very cozy relationship between universities and for-profit institutions, pharmaceutical companies, technology companies. One chief law was the Bayh-Dole Act, which allowed universities for the first time to take molecules and discoveries that were developed with our tax dollars, with federal funds, and to sell and license the patent to them. Corporations. Now, the idea was a positive one. The idea was that this would encourage development of more and better medicines that we needed. But instead, it's had the opposite effect. It's had the effect of turning medical research from this public goods-oriented culture into a corporate culture, where very often, if you look at university research systems, they look to me very much like the arms of corporations. and they behave like corporations. They're motivated by patent profits now, and that has not resulted in the good medications that we had hoped for.
And there's a lot of information in your book based around this, and I want to get this to this. We're having a little bit of kickback. This is a live show. We're having a little bit of kickback on the call here. So I'm going to cut to break a little early, Harriet, see if we can get a better line, because I want to make sure that our listeners can hear this information. It's really important.
Sure.
So please stay with us. Harriet Washington is my guest. Her book is called Deadly Monopolies, and you'll really want to hear what Harriet has written about. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
Coming up November 28th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, business consultant Tom Salinak on why the economy has little to do with business growth if you're doing the right things. We'll share what those things are, and Vicky will ask leading psychologist Jason Selk how to develop the mental toughness you need to take you to the next level. Join us at noon Pacific every Monday for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow Vicky on Twitter and Facebook at Vicky St. Clair.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Harriet Washington. She's a medical ethicist, award-winning author. Her new book is called Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself. We're looking at what this means to the consequences of our health and our medical future. Harriet, so we talked in the beginning about why you wrote this book. I want to just point out that according to information in your book and that I found too, the U.S. Patent Office has granted patents on more than 40,000 genes. So let's talk about what that actually means to us. You know, why should I care if a pharmaceutical company has patented a gene that is in my body?
It's extremely important. I want to add that these patents are not only on genes, but also on genetic sequences, DNA sequences, whose full utility and full use and full purpose is still unknown. But when they take out a patent, they not only can control what they do with it, they can also prevent anybody else from using that gene. And this is where most of the problem comes in. Because when a company takes out 100 patents on the hepatitis C virus, as the Chiron Corporation has done, it can send cease and desist letters to researchers who are looking for treatments and cures and tell them, you cannot work with this virus unless we give you permission. And for a very long time, Chiron Corporation refused to give many others permission to work on it. We very recently have some new, better treatments for hepatitis C, and that's only because after a while, Chiron had to relent. There was so much criticism of them for keeping researchers from access to this virus that they finally had to relent and let others work on it. However, in the UK, something really interesting happened. In Great Britain, people who wanted tests for hepatitis C to find out whether or not they were infected with the virus, suddenly the test became unavailable. Suddenly, the cost of the test rose sixfold.
Wow.
Why? Because a former company named Nurex had been offering tests that were cheap. The National Health Service could afford to test anybody who seemed to have the indications needed the test. Chiron sent them cease and desist letters saying, we hold the patent on this. If you continue to use the test by this other company, we're going to sue you and them. And the National Health Service had to adopt Chiron's tests, which were so much more expensive, they had to start rationing the test. And people were writing me. I happen to have written a book about hepatitis C, and people were writing me to complain that they couldn't get tested in the UK. It's a very good example. Another really good example that will resonate with a lot of people is what happens with the breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2. These genes, the patents are held by Myriad Corporation. It owns 9 patents on these genes. And the result is that a woman who fears that she may have a genetic risk and wants to characterize that risk either to try to avoid breast cancer or to better characterize the best treatment for her has to pay between $3,000 and $4,000 for the test.
Oh.
That was the situation when I wrote the book, and that was bad enough.
Right.
But there's been a recent development I find very, very troubling. The recent development is after you pay the $3,000 or $4,000 for that test, the technician will turn to you and say, there's another test that will even better characterize your cancer and better pinpoint the best treatment for you, but it's going to cost you another $600. So this is why these patents on genes are extremely dangerous. And what's really horrible to contemplate is what's happening here in the West, that's the best-case scenario. Because if you go to countries like India and Nigeria, nobody there has that kind of money.
Right.
Nobody can even afford the test. And as long as a private corporation has a patent in its hands, they can charge whatever they like
right.
for the test.
Right.
Except I do want to mention, though, that many countries, though, put a ceiling on what companies can charge, Canada, for example, but the United States doesn't. So in this country, they charge literally what the traffic will bear.
Well, there are so many good examples in the book, and one of them that I thought resonated, because most people have heard of Monsanto and, you know, the problems we've had with GMO and farmers over here not being able to buy seed from anywhere else, you know, talk about a monopoly. And you use the example of that in India, where farmers are committing suicide because they just can't afford to farm anymore at an alarming rate. Use the example of that to show how things might go if this patenting of genes continues.
Exactly. What's happened in India is nothing short of terrifying. We have hundreds and thousands of Indian farmers. Suicide has become an occupational hazard in India because the government appointed farm workers, farm advisors who are supposed to advise people, most of those positions are not filled. So the poor peasant farmers in India have nowhere to turn for reliable advice. And Monsanto instead sends its sales agents, and it convinces these farmers to buy its seed. Now, it tells them that if you buy our seed, and they have several brands of seed, one of the characteristics of their seed, though, is that unlike traditional farming, subsistence farming, where peasant farmers depend on the ability to reserve some seed from every crop for the next year's planting, you can't do that with Monsanto seed. They have what's called terminator seed technology. You cannot replant the seed. Even the hybrid seed, which can technically be replanted, doesn't yield very well. So, but no one warns the farmers about that. They tell them the seed is going to be wonderful. It'll double your crop. You'll make a lot more money. You're going to come out of debt. Instead, when they buy the seed, they learn belatedly that they have to buy water, which is very expensive in these parts of the world.
Right,
they have to
right.
buy water. They have to buy fertilizer. And in fact, they also have to buy a very potent pesticide because the way these Monsanto seeds work, many of them, is that they're immune to Roundup. So they're not affected by this very potent, very dangerous pesticide Roundup. and Roundup, the seed is planted, and then Roundup is saturated in the whole field. It kills everything except for the Monsanto seeds. Now, this is a problem in and of itself because it's such a dangerous pesticide, and these farmers do not have protective gear, so they're at risk of being poisoned. And I suppose the most truly tragic to me, really wrenching feature of that, the way the farmers most often commit suicide is by drinking the pesticide.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And Monsanto's stance is quite Orwellian. You know, I think it's really important to point out that I'm not against capitalism. I'm not against companies making money. I am against companies being allowed to make so much money to the exclusion of protection of patients and consumers, allowed to make so much money that people die because they can't afford basic medications. And in this case, Monsanto's approach is truly Orwellian. Not content to saturate the earth with a potent pesticide, they often sue farmers for using their seed without permission. And how do they define that? The seed is patented, which is why they can do this.
Right.
They define using the seed without permission as the wind blowing the seed onto your plot. I'm serious.
Right, right. I've heard that many times,
so,
yeah.
It's amazing to me that in the name of profit, companies are allowed to do such things.
Mm. And so that, I think that's a great example of you know, something really gone awry. And it's very similar to what's really happening with the pharmaceutical companies and the patenting of genes and DNA series. Tell us the story of the Icelandic saga, where they made all kinds of promises to Iceland if they gave up their medical records.
I think the Icelandic saga is so important because what it highlights is, unfortunately, we have come to expect for people in the developing world to be abused in this manner. We do not expect for Westerners to be abused in this manner. But in this case, in one sense, you could say that Iceland was treated like a developing country. What happened was that Iceland researcher decided that he could make many scientific advances and make a great deal of money by taking advantage of Iceland's very unique features. Iceland has a very, very rich historical medical database. All the families in Iceland have their medical histories recorded, can trace them far back. This is extremely unusual for an entire country to have its entire, you know, medical records inscribed. Now, of course, Iceland believes in traditional privacy. So although all these records are available, anybody just can't access them. I mean, you do have your privacy. However, in order to pursue his scheme of marrying these medical records to a widespread genetic profile of Icelanders with identifiers, then people would have to give up that privacy to a private corporation that he headed. And he convinced the Icelandic government to do this. He traded on the fact that, on his promise, that by melding this Icelandic medical database and genetic database together, they would be able to identify the genes for many diseases, could come up with a lot of medications, make a large amount of money, and he said it would not only improve the wealth of Iceland, but it would also be great for the national pride and an Icelandic company being able to come up with all these medical innovations.
Mm-hmm.
And the government went for it. The man Vern voted for it. And even though there were problems with informed consent, because one of the features of this was that instead of people have been given consent forms and saying, do you want your information to be made available to a private company? Instead, it was an opt-out situation where you had to come forward and say, no, I don't want this done with me.
Right, and so they just presumed consent unless somebody opted
exactly,
out.
Which is a very novel way of using presumed consent. And by its design, certain people were overlooked, left out. There were some people who never got a chance to say yes or no,
right.
You know, including people who attained the age of majority during this process, people who were imprisoned. I mean, so it was flawed, but the Icelandic people decided the sacrifice was worth it. Unfortunately, like many biotechnology companies, even though the company did indeed identify genetic sequences associated with disease, it was never able to make a working marketing model for it. It was never able to make any money. Many people in Iceland sunk their savings and invested in this company. It's called Decode. People abroad as well, but Icelanders, because of national pride and because they had a sense of ownership, many of them invested in it. almost all of them lost a great deal of money, if not everything. And the only exceptions were a few early stockholders, people
right,
like that.
Right.
So, but the loss of money was serious. But what was even worse was that Decode went bankrupt. When it went bankrupt, it was acquired just like any other company by other people, outsiders. It was one thing when a famous Icelandic doctor and his Icelandic staff were appropriating the genome. Now it's outsiders from other countries in a company who owned this. So basically, the Icelandic people have had their privacy violated, have had their genome and their medical history sold to private corporations. A private corporation, the new Decode, which is still struggling to find a business model, but meanwhile, they've lost money, they've lost national face. Everything they were promised has not happened.
Right, right.
And the only people who are the beneficiaries are those few people associated with Decode who were able to invest and get out before they lost money.
Yeah, it's so shocking. It's really disturbing. And I want to talk a little bit more about presumed consent, because that's also used here in the U.S., I read in your book,
yes,
to surreptitiously harvest
cadavers. It's used widely, but with a total lack of transparency. Another reason I wrote the book was because I could see where presumed consent was being championed more and more. And basically, presumed consent is exactly what it sounds like. It's not informed consent, where someone gives you all the information you need to make an informed decision and you make a free, voluntary decision. Presumed consent is some researcher or some university or some private company saying to you, we presume that if we asked you, you would say yes. So if you don't want to be part of this, the onus is on you to come forward. Well, what's the problem with that? What's the logical problem with that?
Well, because we don't know what's happening.
Yeah. That it's being conducted. And unfortunately, presumed consent is being used in many, many situations where American people have no idea that they are being used in medical research without their permission or knowledge. No one is publicizing it, and they're just being subjected to it with a total lack of transparency. A really good example of presumed consent is it's being used in most states in this country. But in certain cities, to acquire bodies, when somebody dies and the body goes to the coroner's office, the coroner has the right to take tissues from that body. The tissues are then sold, and they're often sold not for research, although a lot of the rationale say it's for research. Not for transplantation, but for research. And the point is that when it's being sold, everybody in this chain makes money. All the brokers that broker the tissues, the surgeons who acquire them, the hospitals that acquire them and use them, everyone is paid except for the person from the tissue was taken. No one paid them. No one asked their permission. No one asked their family's permission. Can we have these tissues? So what happened to Henrietta Lacks, as detailed in that book, what happened to Henrietta Lacks is now something that can happen to any one of us if we live in the wrong city. And it's being used even beyond that, even beyond the appropriation of dead people's bodies. It's also, unfortunately, non-voluntary research has become more and more common in this country. It's becoming common because it saves money.
Right, right. So even if we don't have a donor card, this can still happen to us by the sound of, taking tissue is, to my way of thinking, it's a breach of, if I haven't signed a donor card, I don't want anybody touching my body, basically.
Of course not. And few people are aware that this can happen to one. But and you're right. We have a right to our body, our autonomy. We feel we have a right to our bodies, although if you look at the law is actually quite sketchy on that point. The law more often makes decisions indicating that we do not have a right to our bodies, although researchers may. So, that's bad, but what's even worse, in my opinion, is the conduct of medical research with no consent. It's very hard for people in this country to believe that there are people in this country who actually are enrolled in medical research without anyone asking their permission, with no attempt being made mm-hmm. to ask it of their families. But the change in the law in 1996, the Code of Federal Regulations, indicated that people who are trauma victims can be enrolled in medical research without their consent. And trauma is a very wide designation. It encompasses heart attacks, gunshot wounds, car crashes, you name it. And there are private companies such as Northfield Laboratories, which have conducted research studies using the bodies of Americans who never gave their consent, who were never even told, never aware that they were in medical research. This is very economical for the companies because they have to conduct their studies within a certain amount of time, typically within 2 years, to get FDA approval.
Mm-hmm.
However, it would take a lot longer than that to recruit people for some of these studies if you were honest with them and told them what was going on. Informed consent in some of these studies would yield you almost no patient. Nobody would agree to these things. And so instead of asking them, people are simply conscripted. And this is all done to raise profits.
Yeah, and I mean, lest people think this is, you know, these are isolated incidents. There's example after example after example in the book. Black and Hispanic kids were given experimental measles vaccines without parents' knowledge. That same year, the Medical University of Southern Carolina was accused of illegal human experimentation when it enrolled pregnant women in a drug treatment. New York City research institutes gave 6 to 11-year-old black boys a drug, fenfluramine, as research into genetically mediated violence. I mean, there's story after story after story, verified story after story. It's really shocking, Harriet.
Right, and what's interesting to me is that all those examples that you just gave that I have in the book,
mm-hmm.
these are all things that were done to African-Americans and Hispanic. However, things have changed, and since the mid-1990s, around the time a lot of those things were being done, we've seen an expansion of this non-consensual research to the general population. So when Northfield Laboratories decided to infuse artificial blood into trauma patients without asking their permission, this is something that anybody who lived in one of the areas where a hospital was pursuing a study could fall victim to them. It wasn't determined by whether you were black or Hispanic. You could just be walking down the street. If you were shot, if you were hit by a car, et cetera, you could find that you could be in that study no matter what race you were. However, according to the company's own data, when I looked at the company's own data, still half of the subjects, a little more than half of the subjects, were black and Hispanic, which is interesting. I realize the reason why is because they chose areas where predominantly black and Hispanic people lived to conduct the study.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a problem for all of us today. Right now, the Research Outcomes Consortium is conducting a similar study, again, without asking people's permission. And it's being conducted in 11 sites in the U.S. and Canada. And many of the people living in those areas have no idea that they can be enrolled in medical research without anyone asking them and being given experimental and sometimes patented products or devices used on them to test them without anyone asking their permission. Very shocking.
It's shocking. It's very, very disturbing. I mean, the numbers alone, $6 billion, that's the monetary value of gifts given to physicians by drug makers in 2000. Goodness knows what it is today. $800 million is what the industry's fictitious price tag is for the cost of bringing a new drug to market. You say the real cost of bringing a new drug to market is about $110 to $240 million.
Right. It's a ballpark, and it's around, depending on the kind of drug.
Mm-hmm.
But the estimates by independent analysts, because the $800 million estimate was something that was approved by the Pharmaceutical Makers Organization. Independent analysts found that the real figure lies somewhere between $71 million and $240 million at the outside, $240 million being for atypically expensive drugs. So the price tag is much, much lower than they say. And this very high price tag is simply a rationale for the very high prices that drug companies charge us. The real reason they can charge us those high prices is because there's no government law putting a cap on the prices they can charge, and because they don't take their case for high prices directly to the American people. They take them to lawmakers, lobbyists employed by the pharmaceutical industry, hundreds of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of dollars every year spent by lobbyists to sway government opinion. Nobody
right.
elects these lobbyists, and yet they are determining how much we pay for our medication.
Yeah, it's shocking. Harriet, you've done a great deal of research on this. I mean, I think there was something like 60 pages of notes and bibliography at the back of the book. It's a very well-documented piece of work. What action can we take? I mean, we hear these stories and I can't imagine that anybody would not be shocked and disturbed by them. What action can we take to try and turn things around?
The good news is that there are people who are pursuing very workable alternative ways of bringing us medications. Probably the number one person in the pantheon is probably Bill Gates. He's done an excellent job of bringing together researchers, developing countries, and including pharmaceutical makers, bringing these people together and coming up with ways to devise cheap versions of medications that people in the developing world can't afford. Not only cheap, it's not just price, it's also the method of administration. For example, you can't use a vaccine that has to be injected. There aren't enough healthcare workers in sub-Saharan Africa or India to do it. You can't use a drug that's got to be refrigerated. So cognizant of all these factors, people like Bill Gates and Doctors Without Borders, Global AIDS Vaccines. I mean, all these groups are working together. They're coming with new models, and the models are working. There are also university researchers who have decided that the old way of research was better when researchers were motivated by the things that were important to them. Mm-hmm. Fame, prestige, bringing new drugs into the world, being revered as a benefactor, those are all very consonant with what we as American patients and consumers need. And so these new researchers, such as at Yale, they've come up with a health impact fund where pharmaceutical companies are paid, but they're paid according to the impact of their drug on the health of the world. For example, a pharmaceutical company would get a lot more money for coming up with an effective malaria drug than it would with coming up for an effective erectile dysfunction drug. We have way too many of those already. So they are looking at the impact on health instead. What everyday people can do is contact their lawmakers. In some states, their lawmakers are already working to do things like repeal gene patents. This is really good. And if they're doing it in California, where you've got Xavier Becerra, Dave Weldon, they're working on a bill against gene patent. In New York State, we've got Patrick Leahy doing the same thing. And Charles Grassley has been very, very instrumental. He used to be head of the Finance Committee. Very instrumental in calling these doctors and these pharmaceutical companies to account when they do things such as raise the price of medications too high, mm-hmm. or when they abuse the conflict of interest rules. So I call on everyday people to make this part of your agenda, whatever group that you're a member of, Amnesty International, your local fraternity, whatever group it is, get together, do a letter-writing campaign, contact your lawmaker, let them know this is a priority for you. Let them know that you want to see a bill from their office that challenges some of these really horribly monopolistic practices that are actually killing people, not just here in this country, but especially in the developing world.
Yes, there's a trail of devastation over there for sure. You've done an incredible amount of research on this, I'm sure, and you've been doing this work for a long time. You've been a medical ethicist for a long time, Harriet. Was there anything that really shocked you when you were doing your research for this book?
I have to say that at this point, it's rather difficult to shock me.
That's what I was thinking.
With that caveat, I am going to say I was shocked, especially by how much collusion there was between rapacious, and this doesn't include every company, but it includes most of them, rapacious companies and the people who are charged with protecting our health. The FDA should be protecting us against dangerous drugs. Instead, the FDA's own evaluators often complain that when they try to keep bad drugs off the market, they are ignored. The reports are put aside and they're simply ignored and stripped of their evaluative roles. Also, the government itself, lobbyists have no place in any kind of healthcare discussion because lobbyists represent a corporate interest whose interest is making money. their interests run counter to those of the American people. And I was shocked to see that these lobbyists are not only influencing lawmakers, but they're constantly changing roles. You know, they're working as a lobbyist one minute, and the next minute they're working in a corporation. The next year they're back working as a lobbyist. It's such a shameless and such a naked display of collusion and complete disregard for the health of the American people that you know, that's what really shocked me. The other things sound much worse, and they are actually much worse, and they may result directly, in people's death, all the other things in the book. But the thing that did surprise me and shock me was the degree to which the people in our country who should be protecting our health seem to have a conflict of interest where they are more interested in protecting the profits of corporations and the rights of American people.
Right, right. How, if I'm going for surgery, how can I protect my tissues if I so choose to? If so many times we are basically waiving our rights without even realizing it.
Then, and it's understandable, it's not easy to do. But the thing to do is at 6 o'clock in the morning, if you are awakened and presented with a sheaf of forms to sign, and there is an impatient doctor or nurse standing by your bedside, tapping their toe, waiting for you to sign them. Either, if you feel you have enough clarity at that point to read them carefully before signing them, do so. If you feel that you don't, tell them so. Because this is why many people go along with this who normally would be a little more perspicacious and ask a few more questions. And it's totally understandable. You're in a very vulnerable position. But insist on, don't sign anything that you don't completely understand and agree with. The fact is the law says they cannot refuse to do your procedure if you refuse to give up your tissues. But a lot of people don't understand that in that sheaf of paper somewhere, there may be a form that asks you to give up your tissues. That's the one you don't want to sign.
Right.
And so you want to be verbal about it and tell them so. They can't legally, refuse to care for you. So speak up.
It sounds like we have to do a lot of speaking up.
Yes.
Seriously, this is such amazing work. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Harriet Washington.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we are talking with Harriet Washington, medical ethicist and author of Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and Our Medical Future. And I don't know about you people who are listening today, but I think this is scary. This is getting out of control. And as consumers, we need to be very concerned about it, I think, and stand up for ourselves. Harriet, you talk a lot about overseas, third world, you know, what's happening in third world countries. And I know many people live microscopically and think, why should I care what's happening over there? So let's start there and then we'll look at some of the research about what's going on.
Yes, what's happening in the developing world is terrifying. Not only in and of itself, because people of the developing world are being used as our research laboratory without regard for their health or human dignity, but also I want to tell this very brief story to show that this medical interdependence that means that what happens in the developing world happens here. Although it's true that we can afford our medications for the most part, and it's true that we have a high standard of health care that they don't enjoy, when research in the developing world goes wrong, it has had its repercussions here. A really good example is a man named Werner Biswota in South Africa, who was doing breast cancer research. He used only black women, and he was administering treatments that were extremely dangerous and proved almost universally fatal to these women. And very, very high doses of chemotherapy. And the women died horrible deaths. In South Africa, poor women, there is very little health care. Even if you happen to live in one of the few cities that had good, had a lot of health care, it wasn't necessarily quality health care. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these cities where they encountered this man who was a researcher at Witwatersrand University, very highly regarded. But he was giving these black women fatal doses of chemotherapy. And unfortunately, his low ethics went beyond abusing black women. He actually fictionalized his research. After they died, he wrote that this very high-dose chemotherapy had actually been a boon. It had saved their lives. It was good for them.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, his work was seized upon by oncologists and women with breast cancer who were desperate for better treatments. And in the West, after a few write-ups, when people read this, they began giving women in the wealthy women in the West high doses of chemotherapy. Now, what's interesting about this is it was only the wealthiest women in the West who could get this because this was not something that had been proven. It was experimental, and insurance companies typically wouldn't cover it. So only wealthy, usually white women, who could afford to pay out of pocket for this therapy got it, and they also died horribly. What's more, you may have heard recently that the very disappointing news that bone marrow transplantation for breast cancer is not the boon we thought it was.
Right.
For most women, and again, I stress I'm talking on average, it doesn't help. And it's a horrendous procedure. It's horrendously painful. It's just, you know, it's just horrific. And many women who go through this, some women who go through this procedure, it's so expensive that it exhausts their health insurance. After they go through it, they can't get health insurance in the future. So, again, this was based on research that was done with poor women of color that was abusive. So that's making my point that what happens in research in the developing world can have a profound effect on our treatment here. But the worst effect for people in the developing world is, of course, they have a dearth of hospitals. They have a dearth of medical personnel. They're desperate for medical care. And so in the midst of this healthcare vacuum in places like rural India and Africa, in come researchers, and they have no problem finding patients because these subjects are people who are desperate for any kind of health care. They're grasping at any kind of straw. So the New England Journal of Medicine recently found that one of every three research studies by a pharmaceutical company is conducted in the developing world, is conducted abroad. And so this is it's being done because it's cheaper. It saves a lot of money. Research there can be done very much more quickly. It also can be done much more cheaply. And so the people of the developing world are actually responsible for a lot of the wealth of pharmaceutical companies. They have to pay a whole lot more if they're conducting their research at home, so to speak. And yet, Michael Kramer of Harvard University did a study showing that over, at least a 19-year span recently, of the 1,300 100 drugs that were devised by pharmaceutical companies, only 4 were against diseases of people in the developing world.
Oh, my goodness me.
So, and this really resonated with me because time after time, I had read research studies where, for example, thalidomide was tested in Nigeria and Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought so horrible, but when I discussed it with researchers, they would say, oh, well, we're testing against leprosy, and leprosy is a big killer in that part of the world. And I thought, okay, that's the rationale. But then I realized, yes, but when you find it efficacious against a disease, it's not available to the people there. And you're not developing for the people there. You're developing it for the people in the West, in the global North.
Mm.
So what's interesting, too, about this argument is that pharmaceutical companies argue that it's true that people in the developing world cannot afford our medications, but that's not our fault. It's not our patents. It's their poverty we should be concerned about. You know, we should be, if these people made more money, then they could get the drugs, but it's not the fact that we have patents. Well, you know, that's basic. It's a really fatuous argument. It is indeed patenting that is raising the price of the medication, but it's also the fact that the discussion often takes the assumption that the people in the developing world are supplicants, that there are people who are being done a favor or asking a favor from us.
Right.
They want us to give them free drugs. They want us to give them cheap drugs. But I say we owe a debt to them because we have those drugs in the first place because of their sacrifice.
Just a dispensable commodity. I mean, that's, you know, the company goes over there and gives this big hooray about how they're helping people out there, and yet they're experimenting on them, and we know some of the results of that. You've listed
yes.
many of them in your book.
Yes.
So how do we encourage transparency? And I'm guessing this is going back again that we have to hold our government accountable. Huge huge task here, but it has to start somewhere.
Yes, we do have to hold our government accountable. I think, the changes that brought us here, the Bayh-Dole Act that I mentioned earlier, and also a Supreme Court ruling called Diamond versus Chakrabarty, that established that products of nature, living things, could be patented. That also was responsible for, the morass we find ourselves in today. All these things began in the law, and I think the answer is going to be in the law, too. But it is also a huge problem that people are unaware of these things, because I think if people were more aware of them, they would already have gone to their lawmakers. They would already have sought to end them. And I thought, that was my mission in this book, to do everything I could to make sure that people were aware these things are transpiring and that action has to be taken.
Yes.
So I think awareness is the first thing. I have to say, I'm disappointed by some medical ethicists. I hasten to say not all, of course, but some medical ethicists seek to excuse some of this behavior. I'll rationalize it. And also, I'm a little puzzled by the reaction of some of the news media, because as somebody who had worked as a journalist for a long time, and I still write the occasional article, I am surprised at how difficult it has been for me to write an article about this. Several times I've gone to outlets, some of which I've worked for before, some of which I hadn't, and I've tried to get them to cover this information. And for whatever reason, there's a huge amount of reluctance.
Advertising, pressure from advertisers?
Who knows? That would be speculation. All mm-hmm. I know is that it's there. And this is really troubling to me, too. Because, frankly, if you can't rely on the government, if you can't rely on an independent news media, if you can't rely on medical ethicists who should be the conscience and the soul of medicine, then who can American patients and consumers rely upon?
Good question, and that's a great note to end today's show on. It's segment on with you, Harriet. I thank you so much for being with us. This is really great work, and just to refresh here, Harriet Washington is a medical ethicist. She's been with the Harvard Medical School. She's been a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, the recipient of a John S. Knight Fellowship at Stanford University. Harriet Washington knows about what she writes, and it is so well documented and researched. Harriet, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing.
Thank you. Yeah, very much enjoyed talking. Thank you.
And again, Harriet A. Washington, the book is called Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself. and the consequences for your health and our medical future. We're going to take a very quick break and we'll be right back with you.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And unfortunately, we could not get hold of our second guest because she has a medical emergency today. She is a doctor. But you know what? I think the conversation with Harriet Washington needed to be had, and things work out usually the way they're supposed to work out. I think we shared some important information here today. And I highly recommend her book. You know, I don't do that too often, but this is really well researched, really well documented. Deadly Monopolies is the book, and it reads really well. It's not like you're reading a textbook. Before we go today, because we have a couple of minutes here, I want to wish Mr. Eric Ryder a happy birthday for yesterday, and I hope you're going to be celebrating the rest of the week today. the rest of the week, right, from today.
Maybe. I don't know. I didn't have any plans beyond this weekend, but I did have fun on Saturday night, and yesterday had some fun as well. So,
well, good. Yeah. Well, I always make a week of it because my birthday is the week of Thanksgiving, and heck, it's just one big celebration.
Party. That's how it should be.
Everybody says, what day is it? And I am like, I don't know what day it is. Who cares? It's just got to be a big celebration week.
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to have it land on a Sunday, but I realize now I've got like 5 more years before I'm back on a weekend rotation with the birthday again. It's just like, you know, your birthday and Halloween, you really want to land on a weekend with, if at all possible. And I just had the last 3 weekends or last 3 birthdays land on a weekend. So I feel like I got lucky. And now I'm going to just have to put up with these midweek birthday things.
Well, you know what? I'll let you into a secret. For the last, I don't know how many years, maybe 20 years, I have taken my birthday off. I never work on my birthday. And that stems back to when I used to work in the bank, and it used to be so stressful because it was Thanksgiving weekend.
Uh-huh.
We'd be so busy, and I'd nearly always go home on my birthday in tears. And so I thought, enough with this.
Exactly.
I'm not working on my birthday anymore. And I've held that true every year. So have some celebration this week, Eric.
Thank you very much. I will.
I want to thank everyone for being with us today. Really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've got feedback or questions on today's show, please do give me a call. You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Or you can email at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. And we're going to be back next week. And I wish you all a great week ahead. Have fun, like Eric. Celebrate his birthday if he's not going to. We will. Live well, live strong.